don't know whether you've come across the Christian comedian, Nick Page. For some people, those two words don't seem to fit together, Christian and comedian. Is that called an oxymoron? I don't know. Anyway, he's written some books, including this one, A Nearly Infallible History of the Reformation. And it includes a little evaluation sheet for all the key players of the Reformation. He gives them marks out of 100 for influence, theological importance, facial hair, general gloominess, etc. John Calvin scores 85% for gloominess. Martin Luther gets just 30. John Knox, the founder of the Church of Scotland, he scores a whopping 98% for gloominess. So after 4 weeks of studying in this book, I wonder where we'd put the teacher of the book of Ecclesiastes on the gloominess scale. If you came a couple of weeks ago when our topic covered work and oppression and death, you might well put him right at the top of the scale. In fact, Jim couldn't get through the Bible reading without commenting on how depressing it was. But I think if we put him at the top of the scale, we've missed an important aspect of the book, which we're going to think about this morning. So I'm not saying that the teacher would be the sort of person you'd choose to go for a walk with. I think you'd rather not, because I expect it will be a pretty uncomfortable time. Because the teacher in the book of Ecclesiastes is a master at bursting bubbles, at stripping away false illusions, at exposing false gods for what they are. So I can imagine the conversation. How's work going, Tony? Oh, very well. I'm designing a new key wall and it's going really well. That's good. But don't imagine it will always be like that. You'll get halfway through and the client will change his mind about what he wants. You'll argue about extra fees, he won't want to pay any more. And then there'll be arguments with the contractor, you'll fall out with him over endless arguments about costs. And even when it's finished, it's not going to last. The steel will rust, concrete will spall off. Probably need pulling down in 50 years' time. Or maybe you'd say to him, oh, we're going well. We've just spent a lot of time and effort and money in having a new kitchen put into the house, and we're really pleased with it. And he'd say, oh, that's good. But the chances are the next person who moves in and buys the house won't like the colour scheme, and they'll tear it out again. And those covers which you spent ages and ages choosing and liking the colour of, they'll just end up in landfill. And I don't think the teacher is particularly negative, but he's a realist. We live, as he says, in the hevel, in the vapor, in the smoke that we can't grasp. We can't fathom the meaning. It's meaningless. In a world that is simple, there are many things that we can't control or understand. As Paul put it, the creation groans in the hevel. The creation groans in frustration. And he also said, now we see through a glass darkly. Well, that's the truth. That's where we live. And it's good, I think, to recognize that rather than to fight it. And as we've worked through this book, the teacher keeps coming back to three themes which he identifies as dominating the life that we live in the hevel, in the vapor, in the mist. And those themes are time, and chance, and death. All streams flow into the sea. This is the poem in the first chapter. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. We dust and hoover the house on a Monday. Next week it needs doing again. We do the shopping on a Friday at Sainsbury's. And by the end of the week, it's gone. We do it again. We do the quarter end accounts in March. We work hours and hours on them. Julian's smiling. And 3 months later, we have to do them again. Same figures, same clients. Just goes on and on. Maybe we're in the wrong job. Maybe we should be in Christian work like Simon. Maybe we should be a pastor like him. But if you ask Simon, I think you'd probably get much the same story. I work all week preparing a sermon. I deliver it on a Sunday morning. I load it onto YouTube in the afternoon. And then Monday morning, I wake up and think, I've got to do it all over again. What am I going to say next week? What's next? And so often we don't feel satisfied with it, do we? The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. And maybe if I was a celebrity or a famous sportsman, it would all be different, I wonder. You can't be much more successful than the Olympic oarsman Matthew Pinsent. But when he was interviewed after winning his fourth gold medal, he said immediately after winning the race, he said, I'm the happiest man on earth, but in just a few seconds I was thinking, what's next? What's next? And the teacher reminds us that we live in time. And he reminds us of this. I've seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. We live in time and it marches on. We don't control it. And secondly, there's chance. Now, as good evangelical Christians, we don't like talking about chance because we believe that God is in control. And I believe that he is. And God doesn't operate by chance. But from where we stand, from a human perspective, under the sun, to use the teacher's phrase, in the heaven, it often looks like chance. So he writes, I've seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favour to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. We can train for a race, and if we do, it's more likely that we'll win, but it's not guaranteed. We can work hard and diligently at our work, and always do our best. And if we do, it's more likely that we'll get promoted, probably earn more money, but it's not guaranteed. We can increase the odds, but we can't guarantee the outcome. There are great stories coming out of Ukraine, aren't there, of Christians who've been experiencing wonderful deliverance in difficult situations, but others are being wounded and are dying. And from where we are, from under the sun, from on the earth, it all seems like chance. There's no guarantee that Christians will escape the pain and suffering. We can try and keep ourselves fit and healthy, and I think we should. It improves the quality of our mental and spiritual life as well as our physical. But there's no guarantee that it will lead to a longer life. It might just bring on arthritis more quickly. And even if it does enable us to live longer, there's no guarantee that we're going to enjoy it. I came across this quote from Kingsley Amis, the author and cynic. He wrote this, I can't think of one pleasure that I'd like to give up for the sake of 2 extra years in a geriatric home. Well, I think the teacher would probably have agreed, actually. There's a degree of chance from where we are under the sun. We don't have control. We can't guarantee the outcome. And then a recurring theme throughout the book is death. In the passage we read that was read to us, all share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good, so with the sinful. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil that in everything that happens under the sun, the same destiny overtakes all. I don't want to dwell on death this morning because we spent some time on the subject a couple of weeks ago, but it's a fact we live with. Unless Jesus returns in the meantime, and he will do sometime, we're all going to die. And we don't know whether it will be sudden or drawn out. We don't know whether it will happen when we've reached a very old age, like our dear friend Muriel, who has gone to be with our Lord this week, or whether it will happen tomorrow. But it's coming to us and we can't avoid it. And as the teacher reminds us in chapter 5, everyone comes naked from their mother's womb, and as everyone comes, so they depart. They take nothing from their toil that they carry in their hands. Our old pastor, Declan Flanagan, told us a story of a funeral he went to of someone who was quite well off. After the funeral, someone sidled up to him and whispered in his ear, "Do you know how much he left?" And Declan is a bit mischievous sometimes. And so he pulled the person to one side and he whispered in his ear and he said, "Yes, everything." And that's the fact of life, isn't it? That's reality. All the money we've saved will get passed on to others. And who knows whether they'll use it wisely or not. All those precious things that we've accumulated, they'll probably end up in the landfill. That's the reality. That's the hell. That's where we live. So given that we live in the hell, what does the teacher advise? Given that we are subject to time and chance and death, what does the teacher advise? How should we live? He's got several bits of advice. So one we saw last week, we should fear God, he says several times. Not in the sense of being afraid of him, but in the sense of respecting him, being reverent towards him, taking him seriously. And that command is repeated several times by the teacher. And again, by the author of the book, who writes the verse at the beginning and a few verses at the end in his concluding remarks. In the penultimate verse, he writes, "Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of mankind." But there's one other important bit of advice which he gives, which may surprise us. Six times in this short book, and it's only 12 short chapters, but six times he tells us we should enjoy life. And the advice normally comes immediately after a passage of doom and gloom, when he's painted a bleak picture of all the problems we face, the effects of time and chance and death, of the futility, the meaninglessness of much of life. But then he suddenly says, so, enjoy life. There was one of these in the passage that was read to us in chapter 9. And again, we must remember that Ecclesiastes isn't God's final word to us. He's spoken to us through Jesus and the resurrection. And if we're trusting in him, we do have a glorious hope that we will be resurrected and will live with him forever. But from the perspective of the teacher living under the sun before Jesus, he can only say this: for the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even their name is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. You can't get much more gloomy than that. But in the very next verse, he says this: go, eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days, for this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. Whatever your hand finds you to do, do it with all your might. For in the realm of the dead where you're going, there is neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. He's saying don't get depressed with the effects of time and chance and the prospect of death. There's no need to get hung up on the past or to worry about the future. We can enjoy the present. We don't have to focus on the hell, on the mist, on the meaninglessness. That's outside of our control. We don't have to worry about it. That's God's concern. We can enjoy our food and our drink and our times with our friends. We can even enjoy our work. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, he said. Put your heart into it, because it will often bring satisfaction. Enjoy life. How can we do that? How can we enjoy life in the middle of the hevel whilst we live in such a sinful world? How can we enjoy our food and drink, perhaps a meal at a good restaurant, when we know that there are so many people living in poverty in our world, when we know that what we're spending could make the difference between life and death for someone? How can we enjoy times of relaxation with friends or family when we know that there's so much work to be done in trying to communicate the good news of Jesus to those who haven't turned to him, perhaps even in our own family? How can we do that? How can we enjoy peace and prosperity when we see such dreadful suffering amongst their brothers and sisters in Ukraine? How can Val and I enjoy a holiday next week, hopefully, when there's so much we could be doing here? I believe that the teacher does give some answers in answering those questions. Firstly, this is not an invitation to unwise or immoral living. The book's last verse reminds us that everything we do is subject to God's judgment. He's not saying, go and break God's commandments. He's saying, enjoy life. Secondly, in chapter 3, which we looked at 3 weeks ago, the teacher reminds us that God sets the times and seasons. There is a time for everything, a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. He has made everything beautiful in its time. There will be times when it's not right to laugh and dance, he says. So we need to be sensitive to God's timing. But thirdly, I think there's a great help in one of the other enjoy yourself passages in chapter 5. Again, it follows a passage full of doom and gloom, where the writer says, this too is a grievous evil. As everyone comes, so they depart. And what do they gain since they toil for the wind? All their days they eat in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. But then again, immediately afterwards, he says, this is what I've observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given them, for this is their lot. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and to be happy in their toil, this is a gift of God. They seldom reflect on the days of their life because God keeps them occupied with gladness of heart. Happiness in their eating and drinking and their work, whether paid or unpaid, happiness is a gift from God. He gives us the ability to enjoy them. And all we can do is gratefully accept this gift when it's given, and to recognize that it's not ours by right, and to accept, I think, that there are times when God may withhold this gift. We won't feel able to enjoy the good things of life. There'll be times when mourning and weeping will seem more appropriate. I've got a couple more things to say, but I really wanted to reinforce the teacher's message that it is appropriate to enjoy ourselves. So we're going to pause for a moment while we're going to serve a drink. There's a choice of alcoholic, Prosecco or non-alcoholic, elderflower. Enjoy. It's okay to enjoy our food and drink. I believe that the teacher's reminder that we can enjoy the present despite living in the hevel, despite living in the mist, despite living in this sinful world, is an important message for us. Because often I think we get so preoccupied with the past and all the scars and the regrets that may be associated with it, and so obsessed with plans and worries about the future, that we forget that we live in the present and that we're invited to enjoy life in the present. It's the gift of God, isn't it, through Jesus Christ, that we're set free from worrying about the things in life that are not under our control, And there are many of those. We can leave those to God. We're set free from worrying about the past. That's gone. Whatever we've done, God will forgive us. We're set free from worry about the future. God cares for us. He will look after us. We're set free to enjoy life in the present. This is what another teacher writing in the 17th century, Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher, mathematician, theologian, everything, I think. This is what he has to say on the subject. We do not rest satisfied with the present. We anticipate the future as too slow in coming, as if in order to hasten its course, or we recall the past to stop its too rapid flight. So imprudent are we that we wander in the times which are not ours and do not think of the only one which belongs to us. And so idle are we that we dream of those times which are no more and thoughtlessly overlook that which alone exists. Let each one examine his thoughts and he will find them all preoccupied with the past and the future. We scarcely ever think of the present. And if we think of it, it is only to take light from it to arrange the future. So we never live, but we hope to live. And as we are always preparing to be happy, it's inevitable we should never be so. Challenging words. I think the teacher of the Ecclesiastes would have said amen to that. Maybe Pascal even had this book in mind when he wrote it. The teacher would have said, don't worry about the past or about the future, but accept God's gift of enjoyment in the present. And it reminds me of what Jesus had to say to his disciples. And to turn to you and me, I think. I used to share a room at our office with an elderly engineer. Well, probably younger than I am now, but he seemed elderly at the time. He was Jewish. And often at the end of the long day, working hard to solve various problems, I'd hear his telephone conversations. Often at the end of a long day, he would shut up his books and he'd tidy up his desk and he'd quote these words. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. And it took me a while to realize that these are the words of Jesus in the King James Version of the part of the Sermon on the Mount. So I want to finish by reading that wonderful passage where Jesus taught his disciples and teaches us. Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow? They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon, in all his splendor, was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough troubles of its own. How do we do that? How can we do that? How can we avoid the worry about the past? How can God forgive me for what I've done? How can we avoid the worry about the future? How am I going to cope with all that lies ahead? I think only by realizing that God is in control and we live by God's grace, and that it's by his grace gift that we are set free to enjoy the present, to eat and to drink, set free from the worry about the past or the future. Someone who realized that was John Newton, the writer of our last song. I don't know whether you know his life story. He was taken to sea at the age of 11. I think he was forced to serve in the Navy as a teenager. He deserted. He was captured, flogged, pressed into service in the slave trade, and eventually he became captain of a slave ship trafficking in human life, responsible for unimaginable suffering. But he was converted to Christianity. He became a pastor in a church in London, and later he became a major influence on William Wilberforce in his work to end the slave trade. How could God forgive John Newton for his evil past? How can he forgive us? Because he is a God of amazing grace. So we're going to finish by singing John Newton's song in a slightly different version. But let's stand and sing Amazing Grace.